little background history of there in the church. But before I do that, I've got to tell you my debut as an actor in the church. I was probably 8 or 9, and I was chosen to be a wise man for the Christmas pageant. And of course, I got all kinds of, maybe I was 10 because I got teasing from my father, but my brothers joined in. The lights must have been out when they picked you as a wise man, so forth. So I got all dolled up in my mother's tablecloth. She had a red and gold kind of fancy threaded tablecloth. It looked kind of oriental. I had that, some kind of a turban, and something to, I was either carrying the gold, frankincense, or myrrh. And this was in Minnesota. And it was Christmas Eve, and it must have been, 10 below out, and a wind chill factor. And we were standing in the narthex waiting for our cue to go down the aisle, bring the gifts to the Christ child. And every time somebody would open the door, all that wind would hurl through the narthex, and we'd just be shivering away. The ushers were trying to figure out when the queue was coming, what aisle we were supposed to go up. And then the unthinkable, the totally unimaginable, the totally opposite of amazing grace happened. Two ushers, I can still remember them. A little guy, Walter Waite, named Newell, another guy. No, Necker was a little guy, Newell was a big guy. All of a sudden, one of them hauled off and socked the other guy. And then the other guy socked back. And then they started to duck around. And there was a first-class fist fight in our narthex in the Holy Church going on at Christmas Eve. These two guys got so distraught and so tense about what aisle the wise men were to go up, they finally could only settle it like men in the narthex. And so we wise men stood by, growing wiser by the minute. At the end of the service is also vivid. At the end of the service, the minister was a very straight, scholarly man. Oh, he was not overly pious, but a revered man of the church there, and very much offended. Terrible thing that these two ushers would do in his church. And he stood there kind of like God on Judgment Day. And I think Necker was kind of on his shoulder crying, and Newell was standing there like this. And then I think one of them said, Necker probably, "All right, I'll apologize if Newell apologized too." I guess they must have both apologized kind of grudgingly. That was my debut in acting in the church. Theater in the church. Well, a lot of the church that we do, a lot of things would come under the category of theater. Think of the stories in the Old Testament. David and Goliath, what a battle out there. And that's been done probably by Cecil B. DeMille in Hollywood. Samson with the temple, pulling it down. Moses fleeing Egypt and all the special effects to get across the Red Sea, you know. So there's a lot of drama in the Bible. And then there's sexy stuff and romance and intrigue and scandal and David and Bathsheba. All the ingredients of drama are there. And then, of course, we come in the New Testament, and what could be more tender and aside from the fist fight in the narthex, but the Christmas story of the babe born in a stable. And you get all the contrast of the rich people living it up in the inn, and we've heard many sermons about that, and the poor that are ignored. So, the Bible is full of drama, and it's been the inspiration for countless plays, countless movies and drama, some better than others, obviously. During the medieval times, about 1000 AD, there was a real movement in the church to have drama. Remember, we're pre-Gutenberg Press, pre-literacy for many people. although literacy goes way back into the Old Testament, people writing and reading, and we know our Lord was literate. He wrote on the ground, remember, when the woman taken in adultery, and who's going to throw the first stone? Another very dramatic scene. But this was an effort to formalize drama in the church and to use it as we use TV. Not very well that we use TV. We did luck out with something like Bill Moyers' Amazing Grace. But I think TV is still pretty much untapped as a teaching tool for the church. This little book on religious drama has a couple of paragraphs I'd like to read to you. The medieval morality play, as well as the mystery or miracle play, rose out of a community of faith possessing a common language of symbols. They understood each other, and remember, we're talking about people who, by and large, did not read and had to use symbols. That's why the Catholic Church is so rich in its symbols of saints and crucifixes and all the rest, as well as other sensory experience, incense, and so forth. This was true of all forms of medieval drama. The miracle and mystery plays generally dealt with familiar lives of saints and with a biblical story from creation to judgment. Creation, beginning of a play. Middle is the drama here on earth. Judgment, heaven, is the final climax and curtain. There were community festivals which retold the story of God's work among people and recounted the biblical events year after year. In addition to their ritual character, they were remarkable teaching devices, particularly because they were not intended primarily as such. They were intended really as part of a worship. I suppose that was the entertainment for the community too. The morality play, see, they weren't trying to just point out a moral, they were just telling the story. But the morality play, in contrast, was a late medieval form of drama purposely aimed at instruction and moral teaching based upon dogma. Here we got theater as indoctrination. It represented a new development that is considered by some historians of drama as a bridge to modern secular theater. However accurate this evaluation may be, the connection at first appears remote. For the characters in a medieval morality play are not fully developed in the manner that modern theater dictates. Neither were the characters biblical figures or saints. Instead, they were abstractions in these morality plays. We had virtue, vice, and good deeds, so forth. So the theater really got going as a, first of all, to tell the lives of saints, tell the biblical story, which was instruction, but then to purposely have a play about good and evil, say, and then characters representing good and evil, virtue and vice, and how virtue finally triumphs, and sin never pays. What is the purpose of drama in the church? And what is religious drama over against secular drama? It's hard to make a distinction, very hard. But I think when we go to a theater, whether it's in the church or in a community theater or Broadway or whatever the main theater might be in your community, if we're made to think and look at life a little differently than when we came in, if it shakes us up, and many times we're not going to think unless we're disturbed. And we hear it, and sometimes it jars us. And we're not sure whether we like that or not. The language might disturb us. If it forces us to think about our lives in new ways, to see ourselves in those characters. Now, all of that could be done without reference to God or Jesus. But if it's done well, as Death of a Salesman was done, I think we have to say, can that be a kind of a prelude to grace and a prelude to God, showing what life would be like without any reference to God? Paul Tillich makes a distinction between religious art, and he's talking about paintings now, and secular art. He says in religious art, there's a deep, disturbing, new insight, something that makes us look at ourselves and the world differently, like a play. It's not the commonplace thing. It jars us. And he uses as example the painting that Picasso did of a Basque town bombed in 1937 during the Franco War. What's the name of that painting?
Guernica,
meaning war. And you remember seeing that? We saw it in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Horribly distorted people, parts of bodies, people bombed, hurt, maimed. It's a disturbing play. Some would say ugly. It was in black and white, very contrast. Well, Tillich says that's a more of a religious play than a Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post used to do, covers showing the little boy, mother tying his tie, and he's got his Bible, and there's his arm, and he's going off to Sunday school. Because it's kind of an idealized picture. It doesn't say what went on trying to get the little boy to that place where you could tie his tie and all the fussing and fighting that might have gone. It didn't say how mother and dad are getting along in the home. It doesn't deal with any problems. It just glosses on the surface. And Tillich and others would say that's illustration. That's an illustrator's work. It's not the work of an artist. The artist goes beneath the surface, brings out stuff that we normally might want to avoid, like Picasso's painting on horrors of modern war. The playwright, then, is always the needler. Not always. But I'm talking about plays that I think can deserve the title of Christian, or religious, or plays that change lives. They're always pushing the frontiers, or as they say today, pushing the envelope. They're not simply Rockwell covers. They're not Father Knows Best, or Ozzie and Harriet, or even Little House on the Prairie. They're disturbing plays. They show the sadness and tragedy and brokenness of life, and the underbelly of life. They're not necessarily there to just make us feel good. Or if they're to make us feel good, we have to go through a little deeper insight in order to come out on the other side and understand what grace is about. Let me give you an illustration. Were any of you here the other night when they showed a play called Night Mother? Okay, young people did it here. And I wish we'd had a better discussion afterwards. We didn't have much of a discussion, and I thought about some things about the play afterwards, the next day or during the night. It's what Walter Winchell used to call cab wit, all the brilliant retorts you would have made to the discussion at the party, and you thought of in the cab on the way home in New York. The play was about a mother. It was a grim play. It was really not a children's play. They issued a warning, this was not for children. I'm not so sure who it's for, except to make us disturbed. And I think I caught on what it's about, I hope. First of all, it was about, on the surface, a mother and daughter who were terribly at odds, a real dysfunctional relationship. And you could see underneath there was all kinds of bitterness going on, and unresolved conflict, horrible things. Well, the daughter in the play announces that she's going to take her life. Just like that, boom. And she then goes through all the business of the gun and the shells and where they are and where she got them, and mother pleading all the time. Then mother tries to cool it and tries to be a little more. But every time the mother says something, the daughter jumps on her, and the mother's very inefficient. Who would be efficient in that situation?
Wasn't the daughter an epileptic?
Is she? Yes. Yeah, but they don't bring that out a whole lot. And it doesn't look like the woman played the part. Looked perfectly well, so you're, but I guess she did have some problem. But then, I think with the play, and then of course they have this terrible climax where the daughter goes in the next room and you hear the gunshot. And the mother falls down in the center of the room and prays, or I don't know if she prays, but there's no reference. No, she doesn't pray. I'm thinking of another prayer I've played that ended with the woman in the center praying. This one is simply left. It's no exit. It's sart. It's godless existentialism. There's no reference to God or grace at all. Not one. And I think what the play could be done in a Christian setting like here, and maybe that's where they were aiming for, but I don't know that we made that explicit. I was not involved in it, and I don't know that I would have caught it quick enough. But now it looks to me like it was a setup to show you amazing grace absent. See, it's kind of the flip side. Rather than show you a nice growth in grace, people getting a hold of grace and saving the day, you've got the absence of grace. The horror of life without any meaning. Life of people that just pass each other in the night. And it's no exit. And that was another play a few years ago. Hopelessness. Despair. The black hole of Calcutta or New York or San Francisco or Palo Alto, wherever. Just nothingness. Nothing. Nothing can save it except for the Christian to look at it and say, hey, that's a portrayal of amazing grace absent. And then I wondered, what would have happened if the woman had been able to refer to grace? Say the daughter, even if she had not darkened the door of a church for years, but then it came to her, her old Sunday school lessons, maybe just embedded in her subconscious. And she knew that God was here, or she related this to Christ on the cross, because it certainly was a crucifixion and a death going on in that room, even though Jesus did not commit suicide and so forth. And so I thought about that, and I thought if this daughter, instead of going out and shooting herself, had been able to recognize God's grace in the midst of that despair.
Can I ask something there?
Yes.
Maybe you're going to get to this, but I'm really lost about why this play and the other play that was done this week were done here in the community. I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
Okay.
It's so grim that I...
Yeah, right. I'll hurry through it and try to get to that. I'm trying to say, I think the plays were done. I'm not recommending you run home and do it at your church. But I think it was done because they wanted to show the absence of grace. Life without God. Life without hope. Life without meaning. Life without any transcendence. You see, if the mother and daughter can't make it, it's all off. The daughter goes out and shoots herself. She's so totally dependent upon the mother for the meaning of her life, and she realizes the mother's world is confined to that kitchen with the old early Salvation Army furniture. Maybe some of you here the other night, and I just wrote a little bit. What if the girl had said to her mother at this point, "Mama, I can't help you until I help myself. And I can't help either of us by killing myself. It's like in an airplane, Mama. You have to first put on your own oxygen mask before you can help anyone else with theirs. So I'm leaving you, Mama," the grace of having to separate. "I'm leaving you for your sake as well as for mine. There's a whole new life out there for me, Mama, and by amazing grace, I'm going to make it. I love you, Mama, but I also love me. And God loves both of us. Goodbye, Mama. God bless." That would have been a different way. And maybe that's what the author wanted to drive us to, kind of negatively. But there's a lot of that today. And there's a lot of plays that don't even think about grace.
Okay,
I'm afraid.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe the author and the people who were putting it on here wanted to have, as you say, a discussion, and they wanted to upset people to say, you know, is this all there is? Wouldn't that be a good platform for
it? Yeah, for a discussion of what difference grace would have made. Is this all there is?
Didn't they have a discussion after?
They did.
Yeah, so I thought, because I know he said after when we saw the other night, Martha's dead, they never do a play without a discussion.
Yeah, the problem as I saw it, I'd invited Mark to be here, who was the director of it. I guess he said he wasn't sure if he could get away. I think the problem from my standpoint of the discussion, when nobody dealt with God and the meaning of life, they were more focused on whether suicide is ever justified. That's what I heard in the discussion.
Same with Margaret's bed, I listened to that, and it seemed to be focused on very secular relationships. I didn't hear anything.
We were talking more ethics than we were theology, and I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
You can have ethics without theology.
For sure.
But you can't have theology without ethics. Right?
I'm not sure.
Can you worship God without talking about how we live as God's people?
You can do it without talking about it. You can't do it without doing it.
That's right.
But that's not a matter of ethics. That's a matter of procedure.
I think once you say the word, I think once you say the word God, you're plunged into something life-changing. Otherwise, you've got kind of an idol, I think. Well, anyway, that's an example. I don't know what they fully had in mind. I think we should have said more. And we can learn from all kinds of people who are not Christians, but by the absence of something, suggest something else. That play was so stark that it almost presuppose that somebody must have known light in order to write something so dark. Gertrude Stein.
A question right here.
Yeah.
Well, I'm kind of confused, but the other night in that Julian thing.
Julian.
Yeah, that book that he talked about, Julian, or Julia, whatever that is.
Julian Norwich, or Jim Branson.
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't.
Yeah.
Yes, I was through Julian. Yes, I was.
Okay,
yeah.
And in there, God, grace. Period. There was no absence of grace. There never was, never will be.
Yeah.
What her
well,
thought was.
Yeah, not. I'm not sure I follow. I don't know enough about her to be able
well,
to deal
I'm
with this.
I'm not worried about her. I'm worried about, is this what it is? God is all, everything is grace?
I think God must be, what do you do with the 139th Psalm? If I make my bed in Sheol, the grave, behold, thou art there. If I ascend to the with wings for the morning, behold, thou art there. God is everywhere, isn't God? And can you say God is not in that room where these people are one contemplating suicide? Is God outside the room, waiting for somebody to find God?
So then there was grace in that play?
I think there was, if you come at it looking for grace. If you come at it saying, what is missing in their lives? Eh? What is lacking? What do they need in order to make it?
Yeah. Well, did they have grace anyway? I guess what I'm saying.
I think grace is there, but they didn't see it. Or it's like maybe somebody having food or water and not taking it. Go ahead.
Well, but that's it was there if you looked for it. And the participant had to see it. You don't have to force the playwright to write it the way you want it. You just view it the way you want it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, if somebody took your play and twisted its meaning completely, you'd be offended. I think the author has not the same integrity I have or the same bias, but it's his play.
Well, as an author, I affirm that.
You cut off what I say, you cut off my little finger.
All right. Well, I was trying to figure out what the author was trying to say in
well,
that.
Well, maybe he was trying to say just what he said, but we're trying to make it be what we want it to be.
Well, I guess I'm saying this, that I would question a church putting on a play unless they had some idea of where it was going and what it was trying
that's
to say.
Question.
Yeah.
That's another issue.
Yeah.
But would you have the director change it?
No, you can't.
Just forget the play.
Well, and you know, if you did a movie script, everybody gets to change it from the grip to the president of Disneyland. Disney.
But in church, would you change it?
No, oh, you wouldn't do it.
Well, you can't do it.
You just wouldn't do it.
If you buy a play, you have to do it the way that it's written. Oh, people slur over a word or two, but they don't change substance. Or you violated a contract in buying that. I don't know they're going to take you to court. I suppose somebody could if you advertised it, big letters, and gave them a different play, and you just borrowed somebody's name. Yeah. Sure, you could. You'd get in trouble that way. Yes?
I just wanted to say that I think it's always a question of conception or interpreting things. Mm-hmm. I'm a professional actor.
Why are you?
So I can say that
good.
You can have a lousy play and to make it very meaningful. I have had some really lousy roles, but I have loved them. Because I have had a feeling that I can give something. Sometimes between the lines, sometimes in the pause, or something like that. And it's also, I think that the author very often doesn't know what he has really written. And this is the great play when it comes out, and you can take very, very many, very much out of the play.
Sure.
What if you haven't changed a word in that play, and the mother in the end goes into a position of prayer, supplication?
I don't think you can do that. That's not written in the play.
Oh. Huh? It's some of the little bit of acting business is your business, isn't it? Not the play.
I mean,
the well, but
she's looking from
a facial expression and gesture.
Oh yeah, but if you have the woman just say sagging on the bed in total despair over against kneeling in prayer, I think you change the meaning, don't you?
Yeah.
It's a good question. Yeah.
One other comment here. I guess I'm thinking about youth work and dealing with kids, and I've been up here in May a couple times too, where we've done some things with the free day with the kids, but usually we do something like this. Also, the person that does that has purpose at the end to guide the discussion to begin
right.
with, at least
right. to
kind of focus like the Amazing Grace side of this, what would have happened. Maybe then you let the conversation go free after that, but to do a little guidance on these plays that happen here. And I don't know if that's stifling or not.
Yeah.
But I work with youth that we kind of go in that direction, or even my classroom in the regular school,
yeah.
too, that try to get a focus to start with, and then maybe the other things can flow afterwards. But at least I try to get a focus.
Get them thinking. To get them thinking. Identifying.
That's what my purpose was, rather than, you know, the what ifs. I don't.
Yeah.
I know you're stifling some, but still.
I think for a play, this was all. It was it, to me. It was all despair. It was almost monolithic and one dimensional. And I think if you're going to do it in a church, you've got to have. If you're going to show despair, you've got to show hope.
Right.
I really think so. Otherwise, why do it in a church? Let there's plenty of people showing despairing plays on Broadway and all kinds of places, and on television even, maybe particularly, some of the ones that try to, you know, to have some sort of phony, sugary solution that are more despairing because they're not very realistic about life. But I think if you're going to show a play in a church, I think you have to ask yourself the question, why in the church? Why in the church? Are we just in the entertainment business? We're certainly not in the business to pound people into further despair, into the pit of their agony. So then you have to ask yourself, why are you going to do it? And the problem that I see in the plays that I've looked at and seen, and the ones I've seen in church, we've had people like the Canterbury players that do kind of morality plays, real quick fix type things, you know, 3 minutes and set up a problem and a solution to it, or hint strongly at what the solution is. That I don't call real drama in the church. Those are more skits. But the plays that have been done for churches like have been done with the idea that they are really proclaiming the gospel in some form or setting people up for the gospel, making them think about the gospel. And if you're going to have a play like Night Mother with no gospel, then I think I want to be very sure that the gospel came in. And maybe it did in the discussion, and I missed part of that. I didn't hear it as much as I would have liked in the discussion. And I could have got up and asked the question that would have, you know, started it off in that direction. And I had some other questions, so I can't blame them entirely. But I think we have to ask that question carefully. We're not just grabbing the first play that we think is going to get a crowd. This Barbara Hermanson, who is an actress who working here now in the bookstore, and I'm sorry you weren't here the other night for the great world premiere of Sister Angie, well, Angie and Michael. And I can say this in all modesty because they made the play work as the actors. I wrote the words. They did the, made it live. You want to say just a couple of words about it, and then maybe, I thought maybe we might read that scene, a couple pages, where Angie's trying to get her, Michael, to phone his father. Maybe I can just give you a quick outline. It's a play about a Monsignor, very successful in Chicago, big church, a school, and Angie's teaching nun in the school. They've had a long acquaintance over baseball, and he's an old kind of jock, and there's no real, you know, sexual or romantic thing going on. Although at the end, you see the tenderness of that thing, and what could have been, kind of, it's there by absence. But mainly, this guy has a real crisis in his life. He discovers he's got aplastic anemia, and that's a terminal illness. We don't have a cure except a bone marrow transplant. He gets a bone marrow transplant. He thinks he's going to be getting well. He gets a bone marrow transplant from, and he's a very sexist guy, from a Lutheran pastor in Minneapolis. And he finds out this was, the Lutheran pastor was a lady, as he said. And she kids him about, you know, I'll never rub it in about your female bone marrow transplant because he's such an old jock. Well, anyway, there's a scene, he has a terrible time with his father, and that influences his ideas of God. And so he's had this terrible pain about his father who really brutalized him verbally, which sometimes lasts longer than physical. And then the father kicked the kid out of the house, the kid came back, and finally the guy says he really was afraid to ever get married and have children for fear he'd do the same thing to his kids. And so Angie gets on to this. Angie is Katharine Hepburn in the 40s, and this guy I thought was Spencer Tracy, but he's really Walter Matthau. And the guy we had was just a young Walter Matthau, gruff and cynical and world-weary. I can't do it. I'm not an actor, but I'll just read it because we've got to move here. Why don't we pick the end of 23? And she's after him about his father and the fact that he's not talked to his father in a couple of years. And the father's blind and probably near death. And now Michael has got this terminal illness too. So that makes it more imperative that Michael move on this thing. Well, go ahead. What's the last time?
When's the last time you talked to him?
I called him on his birthday 2 years ago.
What happened?
It was a disaster.
Huh?
Well, he's blind, so apparently he didn't see my mother trying to put the phone in his hand, so he blurted out. He said, "What does that damn parasite want now?"
Then what did you do?
I hung up.
Have you talked to him since?
No. I talked with my mother frequently, but I've given up asking to talk with my father.
Here, call me. Call your father and wish him an early happy birthday. And then he hesitates a lot.
Yeah, he doesn't.
And I say the line that they really like, "You can do years of therapy to get to this point, or you can do it right now."
Yeah, but what if he just refuses to talk to me again?
Then it's his problem. You're doing this more for your sake than his.
Wait a minute here.
Michael, it's not something you have to think about. We don't think ourselves into new ways of feeling. We act ourselves into new ways of feeling. Okay, ask for long distance, He's an old man, and this may be the last happy birthday you get to wish him.
It's a losing battle just to keep from hating his guts.
I know, but call him. You can't afford to wake up another morning trying to decide whether or not you ate his guts today. Come on, take the leap of faith and call him for your sake. You'll feel better.
And he calls his father. His father refuses to talk with him. And well, anyway.
What I wanted to say also, yeah, that back in here on page 59, the words of that really meant something to me too. And he's talking about it's too much work to get up every morning, you know, deciding to hate his guts and all that. And I've been dragged kicking and screaming to the conclusion I have to forgive him. And then he says, if there was some amazing grace, you know, I would tell the old bastard I still love him. Mm-hmm. And she says, I think maybe your wish is the answer to your prayer. And that's neat, I think. I get goosebumps through a lot of this stuff. But part of what I wanted to also put in, if I can put two things,
sure, please,
in,
no, yeah,
is when you talk about your youth, we've had feedback from every age on this. The boy that was taping it was a teenager. And he said, this is great. Because they do relate to this. These kids feel these things a lot, and they have a lot of struggles with their parent, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so the kids felt that way. I felt, and I got the feedback from every age group on this. And that's why I thought it was interesting that it can really mean something to them from where they're coming from.
You really have to catch an actor doing that, not me, because yeah, these two really had a chemistry going. Mm-hmm. And the guy that was doing the acting, he just fell into this part. And he was,
there's a lot to say there. And there's a lot of things that people have questioned in our feedback, and that's why the feedback was so fun and interesting, I thought, yeah, because we got some feedback on some of the technicalities of what was said about the church and what was said about the feelings there and the strength that we used with it. It was a very realistic thing to a lot of people, and a lot of people identified with it.
There's a scene there. You're always pushing the boundaries, see? And I hesitate to write this because I knew it would probably offend church people, and yet I wanted them to think about it, and I thought it was biblical. You can argue with this right now. And that's that he's so despondent about God being like his father. Doesn't seem to listen, doesn't seem to care. He can never connect with his father, and he can't seem to connect with God. And he's been a good priest, and he's been good at it, good professional. And she says to him, well, how can you go on preaching and doing the sacrament? He says, I'm a natural.
Pardon? Going through the motions.
Going through the motion, you see. And I took what I think happens to every one of us. Remember Luther talked about the hidden God, or you go through a valley, a desert experience. Every minister I've ever known has said there are times where it felt dried out and dried up. And that's, thank God, usually a temporary thing. Doesn't last too many weeks. Congregation probably knows it before the pastor does. But it happens. And then we come back again and hopefully, you know, are renewed. But you walk through those valley of the shadow of death. And he's all got a long, see, now we're exaggerating everything in the theater. That's what the theater is. It's an exaggeration of life. And to make a point, you got to go past what normally happens. So I just took that desert experience, that dryness, that hidden godness, and carried it on for, he lost his faith 14 years ago or so. But he just kept on doing it. He was real good. He got to be man of the year in Chicago and a real gung-ho fundraiser, you know, one of these go-go guys. And he could do it without faith. Well, then he comes back to this thing with God, and God seems to be dangling him on a string. First of all, the bone marrow, he has a remission. And he goes out charging in. He's man of the year, and he's head of a youth task force in Chicago, and the mayor's right-hand man. And then they find out it was just a remission. The bone marrow really hadn't transplanted. And so he's back in the hospital. And there's a lot of other dialogue that gets him to the place where he's angry at God. And I thought of Job. And remember how Job's wife said, curse, and he had all those plagues and boils and everything came to him, and then she said, curse God and die. And he was too righteous a man to do it, too inculcated a Jew, too afraid of God, you know, Jehovah, You didn't even mention his name. So he didn't, even he thought about it. It seems to me Job saying he's cursing God, but he's not doing it aloud. He's afraid to do it aloud. So I just pushed the envelope here and said, what if the guy really did? And what if he finally said, his father, when he was just about, Michael was just about to become an Eagle Scout, only 6 merit badges to go. And his father was helping him, went out overnight, camped with him. Father was one of these guys that he'd give him a lot and then he'd take it all back. And then it was even worse for him. So he's 6 merit badges to go. And his father's encouraged, and then his father gets real mad at him. And his father's idea to say something that's going to, I don't know why. I don't know why the father does it. I just know that fathers do it. And this happened, so it's not an exaggeration. And he says, you're not going to become an Eagle Scout. You're going to become an Eagle Shit. Well, you know what that did to his scout career. And so Michael is confusing God and his father. He can't see God because that father is standing between him and God. So he says to God, he gets mad at God, and he says, I'm not going to be your Eagle Shit anymore. And then he finally says the unspeakable. God damn you, God. It's a little bit of humor, because how can God damn God? Also, what do you think, for a moment, is God more offended by a deeply felt curse because he really wants to believe in God, but he can't at that point? Or somebody blasé, doesn't care, oh God, okay, yeah, I'll throw God in the, you know, a little more God over here, you know, a little more pinch of sugar in the recipe. I don't know, I can't, I'm paid to speak for God. That's an absurdity, of course. But I don't think God would be as offended by a deeply felt curse. And how close is a curse to a prayer? So I just had Michael saying what Job was afraid to say. And that may flip some people out.
Well,
in the church.
It was a matter of forgiving God and God forgiving you, and it was, you couldn't forgive God. And that's anger. You know, it's the anger that people normally feel. It's just a very major anger.
Were you there? You folks were there, weren't you?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you speak up?
I remember that part of it. Mm-hmm. And since the play was about losing the faith and regaining it, well, he's cursing God, but if he doesn't believe in God, if he has lost all that, how can he curse God?
So he really did believe. Yeah, he wanted to. He wanted to believe in him.
How can you curse something that doesn't exist?
Yes.
You know, the opposite of love is not hate or cursing. What is the opposite of love?
Ignorance.
Indifference, apathy.
But the part is, again, the person that's filled with the anger is the one that paid the big price. He's the one that suffered all this time, too, because he's had all this anger built up and all the time. He's paid a major price for that
hate. He almost had to get mad at God in order to get back to his father. That sort of went round and round.
I like the, can I keep going?
Sure,
I guess because I still think about a lot of this, and I keep thinking about how this worked through and how the ending happened, you know. But when he gets back to the ending where he says, in the confession, I've sinned before heaven and my brothers and sisters, I've tried to create God in my own image, I haven't been satisfied to serve him, I want to control him, I wanted the joy without the suffering, you know. And so then he asks for the forgiveness, but I've been unwilling. And then, in the next part, he says, have mercy, God, upon me and upon my father. In other words, I do forgive my father. That's what that says to me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking he's saying my father, the human father he has. Don't you? And so that's what, I picked that out of that and thought, I really got goosebumpy because I can identify with that story.
I'll give you a choice right now. We can either break into small 2 or 3 group, and you could name a play or a movie and deal with the question of whether this is the kind of play or movie you could show in your church where there's religious meaning to it, or we could all stay together for a little bit more. How do you feel? You want to break up? You want to stay in?
Stay together.
Stay together. All right, let's do a quick one here because I think this illustrates. Let's get 2 other people, though. It's only going to be about a page. here of the opening of Death of a Salesman. And Willie has come off the road in his Studebaker. And remember, he's in his 60s. He's so burned out, so worn out. His dream has died all around him. He can't be that great super salesman. And he realizes he's washed up now. And he can't quite say it, but it's there. And so he drives his car home, and he keeps going off the road. He's not drunk. He's just blurry. You can't see anymore. It's a symbolism. I guess I don't know where I'm going. And so he comes in, and he comes back early, remember? He just had to return. He said it took him 4 hours to go from Yonkers to New York, where they live, maybe in the Queens. And drove 10 miles an hour. So he comes in the house. Here it is. Here, you be Linda. Who wants to be Walter here? You need a Walter. You be Walter? Not Walter. Willie. And just read from here to the end of that page. And you be Willie and you be Linda. He comes in the door now, all weary with his bags.
Okay, should I start? Willie.
It's all right. I came back.
What? What happened? Did something happen, Willie?
No, nothing happened.
You didn't smash the car, did you?
I said nothing happened. Did you hear me?
Don't you feel well?
I'm tired to death. I couldn't make it. I just couldn't make it, Willie.
Where were you all day? You look terrible.
Got as far as a little above Yonkers. I stopped for a cup of coffee. Maybe it was the coffee.
What?
I suddenly couldn't drive anymore. Car kept going off onto the shoulder, you know.
Oh, well, maybe it was the steering again. I don't think Angelo knows the Studebaker.
No, it's me. Suddenly I realize I'm going 60 miles an hour, and I don't remember the last 5 minutes. I can't seem to keep my mind to it.
Maybe it's your glasses. You never went for your new glasses.
No, I see everything. I came back 10 miles an hour. It took me nearly 4 hours from Yonkers.
Well, you just have to take a rest, Willie. You can't continue this way.
Just got to get back from Florida. I just got back from Florida.
But you didn't rest your mind. Your mind is overactive, and the mind is what counts, dear.
I'll start out in the morning. Maybe I'll feel better in the morning. I don't like to do this, but I guess I'll say it. These goddamn arch supports are killing me.
She's taking out the
sheet. Yeah. Is that for enough?
Yeah, that's enough, I think. What does that say in terms of how could that play, or do you think it would connect with the gospel in any way? Is Death of a Salesman a play that for instance, you might want to put on in the church or see the film? There's several versions of it. I didn't particularly like the Dustin Hoffman, the latest one, but the earlier ones are better, I think. There's several actors that have done there's a number of people who have done it. I can't think of them right now. But how do you feel about Death of a Salesman? Oh, you all know Death of a Salesman, don't
well,
you?
Well, it is it's suicide, isn't it?
At the end?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is suicide at the end. Mm-hmm. And so we got maybe another Night Mother, but not quite, because this plays out a lot longer. And there's more characters. How do you feel about that?
But at the end, I've forgotten what happened.
Are you playing to a cross-section of people? Or are you playing to young ones, all ages, or what?
Well, let's say you've got high school and up. Say that you got a young adult group, and they come to you and they say, "We want to put on Death of a Salesman in church."
Do you think we should read the very end?
Well,
or can you want to?
Well, he goes off in the car, and he, the.
I think that those things are powerful. I think anything like that. This is a secular play that can be done anywhere. It isn't a church play, of course.
Right.
But it has a major message, and again, depends on how much you want to get into the message. I've seen a suicide play done by teenagers from Owatonna, Minnesota, that traveled around doing it. Wonderful. because the kids, they identify with that. And suicide is definitely part of what's happening in the world.
If you're going to do suicide with teenagers, you better have some hope. You better talk about hope.
They did, and the kids took it and lived with it.
Well, then you better have kids that are going to respond to that play.
You know how they responded? Two of their friends in the church did do suicide, and the kids had to do something with it. It was an Owatonna, Minnesota group, and they traveled through and came to our church and shared the gospel. And it was powerful. But they had to do something. They were all just searching for answers. It's one of your friends. Two of your friends.
I'd want to ask afterwards, how could Willie have been saved? What would have made a difference? Why did Willie have to appear as such a braggadocia, so Superman in front of his sons?
Yep.
Why do fathers have to play that role? Why can't fathers, why can't we be vulnerable with our kids? I don't know, but it's been a play that the church has dealt with, and churches have done it, churches have gone to see it, and talked about it. I think it's the kind of play that invites discussion afterwards. Mine did too. And I think that's very key, that if you're going to do some of these realistic, hard-hitting, modern plays, be sure that you bring in some way of dealing with hope and grace. In the play that Marco and Angie, here's this sexist guy, and they have a lot of fun with the idea of why women can't. Are too emotional to be priests and all that kind of stuff.
But there's some sense in that too, though, you know, the women being in the clergy now and the fact that we have some gifts to give too that are balanced out.
Right.
So
but at the end, he's dying, and he calls her to his bedside, and he even tells her he loves her, and she says, "I love you too," but she said, "Aren't you worried?" And he says, "About what?" And she said, "About a scandal." And he says, "At our age, Angie, we need all the scandal we can get." And then he asks her, "Why don't you tell what he asks her to do?"
Well, he pulls all his tubes out because that's when he decides that, you know, he's at that point where he says that kind of thing, and he gets up out of his chair and says, "I want to make my confession," and gets down on his knees and does the confession to her. And she becomes, the roles reversed, she becomes the priest, he becomes the transgressor that wants to confess. And that's exactly what happens. So then that's how the thing ends. We discussed this before, but I had to go on, and it was hard for me as taking the role of the priest to become that much of it. And he made her say the rest of it, you know, "I absolve you from your sins, I forgive you. In the name of I want to say the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, it's the Creator, Redeemer, and Holy Comforter." But then the ending is, too bad dying is the last thing we have to do, Angie. It could teach us so much about living. And she says, "Well, we're still all learning. We're still all learning, Michael." And the ending was, maybe even God is still learning. You know, and maybe even God. So that's the end of it. But the part is that we still, nobody knows the whole answer to everything. We still have to learn to our last dying breath. We're still learning. Nobody has all the answers.
I couldn't write a play unless it had hope at the end. I don't mean sanguine come to Jesus, everything will be hunky-dory. I think coming to Jesus many times is going to create more problems than you had before, but they're going to be more important problems and worthwhile problems. But I can't imagine doing it. But I do think there's a place for things like, Night Mother was too stark. I wouldn't have done that because it was too despairing, and I wouldn't have done it with kids. Adults, I think, maybe can put it in perspective. Just an aside here, the trouble with teenagers at this point is that it's called a disease of the young, suicide. And a lot of the kids have lived rather comfortable, privileged lives. And then all of a sudden, the first real crisis, the first, you know, girlfriend jilted me kind of thing, you think, what in the world are we talking about? That's just puppy love, you'll get over it. Oh, anybody comes to you at 15 or 16, you know that. You take it seriously.
But
so,
they feel depression more than anybody I know.
So I wouldn't deal with just dark depression in a church play. I think I'd find a way then to use it as a catalyst to talk about it. Willie Loman is a middle-aged guy, or 60s, and that resonated with salesmen all over the place, and not just salesmen, but all kinds of people. And it's a marvelous opportunity to talk about, what do you do when your dreams weren't fulfilled? Are you all washed up? Is it the death of a salesman because you didn't become president of the company or sales manager, and you didn't shine as a big star in front of your kids? Where do you go from here? Where do you go when the human dream fails? How does grace see you home?
Where is the grace in this?
I think it's, again, the absence of grace. I think Miller's saying, if you live life just on the terms that Willie did, with a smile and a shoeshine, you're in trouble. If all you've got going for you is a smile and a shoeshine and the old contacts you had, those old friends died off. You go in this, I know this from my father was a salesman, my mother was. They go there and the old buyers are gone now. And they've changed things. And they don't order by the salesman anymore. They just order by the telephone, the catalog, the computer. And so Willie's replaced by a computer. Okay, is there still hope for him? You got to think that thing out and say, why would the church want to just leave people hopeless? I don't think so.
The only real hope or grace in this is what comes from the discussion afterwards.
What's implied here? Yes, I think the discussion should bring out these things. Right.
Faith is a choice. And I mean, it is a choice. Everybody still has a choice. No matter what happened to you, what happened to your childhood, you still have that
bottom line
choice.
Let me just throw out a few practical ideas that I've thought about. If I were to try to do some, and I hope to do it when I get back somewhere in our church or somewhere, I'm free now to be able to do more of these things. I'd think it'd be kind of fun to get a small group. Then it'd be four, five, six people. Who maybe, if it's small enough, they could go to a movie together or watch a tape together. I think that watching it together is important. And go to a play together, and then get together, you know, over a little wine and cheese or whatever, and talk about it. Then they might, now if they get to the point after they've seen some plays and read plays to each other, they might want to say, how can we do something in the church, some drama in the church? And I think at this point, they should begin to look through all of the different plays and possibilities and things that have been written. And, you know, there's some very more obviously Christian plays. A Murder in the Cathedral comes to mind. But other that are written from the stage, I think this could be done. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf sets up a real dialogue about marriage and people who, again, are passing each other all the time. And then I think that the drama group in the church could begin to think about how they would involve the rest of the congregation. Do they want to put on a play here? A lot of frustrated actors around, director. They've got to, you know, really work it and be very intentional about this. They can produce it right within the congregation. A lot of plays are in the public domain, so you don't have to pay anything for these plays. But there's other plays that you might, you know, here's one, that religious drama. This is put out in 1959. I doubt if any of these plays still require royalties, but you could find out. The Last Word, The House by the Stable, Grab and Grace, Santa Claus, Let Man Live, It Should Happen to a Dog, Billy Budd, and The Gospel Witch. Now those are one act, some cases two, an hour at the most, and then some way of sharing the insights. And not being afraid sometimes of some, I think we might turn away some things because they may seem too realistic or the language that bother us. But you have to ask about language. I thought twice about the curse, and I thought twice about the eagle shit, but that's what he said.
Yeah.
And you have to say what the man would say. I think where language becomes objectionable is when it's done gratuitously, just for the effect, just to shock people, like the movies. You know, some of the movies, if they left out certain words, it would be a silent movie. You know, that's all I can say. And it's gratuitous. It's no longer even shocking. But where it fits the character and brings out a little kid thinking, what am I going to do now that I'm an eagle shit? You have to say the word, otherwise you don't know how deeply the kid felt about it. Well, anyway, any questions, any thoughts here? Yeah.